This is the Sunday school lesson for July 12th.
We certainly are glad to have the ladies with us any time. Somebody remarked last Sunday that this was a little like a shaker service when you put the women on one side and the men on the other. I think that's the way they used to do it. We have another lesson from Deuteronomy, these two lessons, last Sunday and this Sunday, both from Deuteronomy. The subject of our lesson this morning is Decisions Determine Destiny. And I'll read just a part of the 30th and 31st chapters. See, I have set before thee this day life and good and death and evil, in that I command thee this day to love the Lord thy God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that thou mayest live and multiply, and the Lord thy God shall bless thee in the land whither thou goest to possess it. And Moses called upon Joshua and said unto him, in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of good courage, for thou must go with this people unto the land which the Lord hath sworn unto their fathers to give them. And thou shalt cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he it is that doth go before thee. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed. And Moses wrote this law and delivered it unto the priests and sons of Levi, which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and unto all the elders of Israel. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release, in the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel is come to appear before the Lord thy God, in the place which thou art hearing, gather the people together, men and women and children, and the stranger that is within thy gates, that they may hear, and that they may learn, and fear the Lord your God, and observe to do all the words of this law, and that their children, which have not known anything, may hear, and learn to fear the Lord your God, as long as ye live in the land whither you go over Jordan to possess it. Moses was a great leader. I think I might say he was the greatest of all the leaders of people. For 38 years, this small nation, coming out of slavery in Egypt, had wandered about and had not gone into the promised land. Their first great defeat came right at the frontier of the land that had been promised, because they were too cautious. And they had to wait until all the disbelievers had been buried. And Moses, with his persuasive power, took this stiff-necked people, and with his great judgment and his constancy, and took the responsibility of leading them and gave them a sense of confidence, taught them, not only laid down the law, but explained the law to them as he did throughout these passages that I have just read. And now he's come to the place where he's 120 years old. 40 years in Egypt, 40 years out as a shepherd, and now 40 years leading this people. He's gotten to be an old man. He has two strikes against him. One is that he's gotten old, and the other is that he failed to give God the rightful honor when the people demanded water down in this wilderness. I think it's a great study of why Moses was not permitted to go into the promised land. I heard a great sermon on that one time. Whether it was punishment or whether it was just the case of a man who'd gotten old in the service and found it necessary to turn the reins over to a younger man. Because you know, a wise leader always trains up a successor. In a sense, a great leader is the greatest at the time he surrenders his power. Washington in his farewell address. And in so many cases, of course, you know there's always a tendency to be a little jealous. Jealous of the young whippersnapper who doesn't know, you think, how to take over and can't do as well as you did, and so on. There's a great feeling of jealousy sometimes, but not with a great man like Moses or Washington. He thought the time had come when the mantle should fall upon Joshua, just as Elijah let his mantle fall on Elisha. The time had come. You know, the whole story of this book of Deuteronomy does not have a happy ending, like, for instance, the book of Job, when everything finally worked out all right for Job. But this doesn't come to a happy ending. Here's Moses coming up and giving them his farewell address, then going off lonely like the proverbial elephant, going off to die by himself. Only the Lord was with him. And he went up there on Mount Nebo. And that was the last that they heard of him. Moses going off and leaving the people. But there's no need to weep about Moses' final ending. He'd been given the opportunity that very few people had of living such a full life. It was the greatest, it was quality and not quantity that counted. And you know, when he went up there on Mount Nebo, he looked over and he saw the promised land. The ambition that he'd had to see these people succeed was sort of revealed to him. He didn't need a tomb. His work was written in the hearts of people, engraved forever in history. You didn't need a tomb or a monument to Moses. You know, it was he, not Abraham or Jacob, that made a great nation out of his people. They were the forerunners, but he was the one that made his people a great nation. His dedication, his keen personal judgment, all entered into his great leadership. God used him as he used no other person prior to the time of Christ as a revelation of his power and his teaching. He'd come to the end, and like Paul, he said, I have fought a good fight. You know, the great prophets, so many times, had a kind of a revelation when they came to the end. Jacob prophesied on his deathbed. Joshua knew when the end had come. Paul, likewise, when he made his, you might say, his farewell, and John in Revelation throughout the whole Bible. And then he didn't enter into the promised land, but you know, 1,500 years after this event, when Christ went up on the Mount of Transfiguration, there appeared to him Moses and Elijah. He did, in that sense, finally come into the promised land. This is a great lesson on growing old. You know, I compared notes, as I do sometimes, with Charlotte Woodbury. She still teaches a Sunday school class. And I said, Ms. Woodbury, what are you going to teach about? She said, well, I think I'm going to go back. I'm going to back to Browning's Rabbi Ben Ezra. And it is very fitting. Grow old along with me. The best is yet to be. The last of life for which the first was made. Our times are in his hand. Who saith, a whole I plant? Youth shows but half. Trust God. See all, be not afraid. And then he comes over some of these other stanzas. Therefore I summon age to grant youth heritage. Life's struggle having so far reached its term. Hence shall I pass, approved a man. For I remove from the developed brute a god, though in the germ. And I shall thereupon take rest, ere I be gone, once more on my adventure, brave and new, fearless and unperplexed, when I wage battle next. What weapons to select, what armor to endue? youth ended, I shall try my gain or loss thereby. Be the fire ashes, that what survives is gold. And I shall weigh the same, give life its praise or blame. Youth all lay in dispute. I shall know, being old. Fool, all that is, and all lasts ever, past recall. Earth changes, but thy soul and God stand sure. What entered into thee that was, is, and shall be? Time's wheel runs back or stops. Potter and clay endure. Well, you know, Justice Holmes, when he got to be 91 years old and finally retired from the Supreme Court bench, and his associates wrote him a letter and told him how much they missed him and how sorry they were about his retirement. And he wrote back and said, remember Stardust says, my brother, may I call you that once more? Your note has so encouraged me, pleased me to get the note of friendship from you. And he said it has added gold to the sunset. It's gold only in the sunset. Well, Cicero talked about getting old, too. There's a whole lot in literature about the way a person should get old, not be discouraged about it. And then he says to these people, you should read and understand the law. Not just read it, but read it and understand it. And he goes on to explain. It's not only a book of laws, as I said a while ago, it's an exposition of the law. This book comes near to going into the problems of life and death than any other Old Testament book. It is one, somebody has said, it is one of the great epic-making books of the world. It taught the necessity for struggle. It's hard for the rich man to enter into heaven because he doesn't struggle, that's the thing. We need a moral equivalent for adversity, and we have it only in faith. We get the Christian doctrine most near in Deuteronomy. You know the difficulty about these early writers in the Bible is they didn't have the devil. They had to picture God as being outraged with what the people did. They didn't have the concept so much in the early writers of the devil. when they studied the law, learned the law, as they did way back in 600 BC after they lost the law and later found it. In England, in Elizabeth's reign, when they first printed the Bible, they began to read it in the churches and in the home. And a great moral change passed over England. They had a book they could read. And somebody said, this Bible is the best investment guide you can get. Better than the Wall Street Journal or a racing form or anything of the kind. It's an investment guide. It tells you how you should invest your life. And you must, I get the idea here that I've spoken of so many times, you must work to understand your life. Christianity doesn't come on a silver platter. You've got to study to understand. You've got to work on it. The whole message that he gives is a very comforting message. I couldn't read all the passages assigned to it. He talks about loving the Lord by keeping his commandments. God is greater than the universe. A river never rises higher than its source. And then he speaks of the everlasting arm over in the 33rd chapter. There's no security without spiritual strength. Last Sunday I spoke to you about Jews as a chosen nation. And I don't know whether I made plain what I was trying to say. Our country, I think, is a chosen nation, brought here for a purpose, with a great mission to perform. Christianity brings a democratic faith. It can be laid hold of by the simplest and the most humble. He says that the most humble, the simplest can grasp it. He says there are three truths about God. One, he's not hidden in heaven so that we cannot understand it. We can understand the message of God if we work at it. Two, there's a capacity of every man to understand. Three is that God never asks the impossible, and man is always able to obey. He spells them out at greater length, but that's the summary. When other helpers fail and comforts flee, help of the helpless will abide with me. And then he says over there in one place, mind you, they had that river between them and the promised land. And he said to them, it is the Lord your God who is crossing over before you. The Lord is crossing over before you. But if we just keep the Bible on the shelf, it doesn't do much good. Or somebody said the devil is never afraid of a Bible that has dust on it. So we must study the law, work it. And the third point I get out of this is blessings come with responsibility. Life's a constant scene of making choices. We have choices urged upon us every day. We have to choose. It's not always pleasant to stand up and be counted. Sometimes it's the hard thing to do. He says, I have set before you life and death. Christ said, he who is not with me is against me. Like Elijah at Mount Carmel, or Paul at the time of the great vision, the time has come for decision. We say there are two sure things in life, death and taxes. But there's another sure thing in life, and that is throughout all of our life, we must constantly decide between right and wrong. The issues put up before you every day, and you must be very careful not to weep. A little child growing up starts out maybe on a career of crime. One little mistake will get him started, and then he'll go on and live a life of crime. It's a matter of decision. Now, why is decision involved freedom and responsibility? When the pilgrims came over on the Mayflower and they signed a compact, and they agreed on certain conduct, they had quite a hard time coming over here. They came over because they wanted religious freedom. They didn't always live up to it as they got here, but that was their ideal. When they signed that compact, they gave up some of their freedom of movement. They had to live with other people. They had to think about the good of the whole and not only themselves. They weren't entirely free after they'd done it. Abraham made up his mind to go from here and on down into Palestine. He encompassed himself with a duty, not only of freedom to go and roam as he pleased. A curse and blessing at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. Then finally, remember, Joshua came along later, and he gathered them together up there, and he said, choose ye this day whom ye will serve. As for me and my family, we will serve the Lord. Constantly making decisions. A boy got a job in the grocery store, and they started him out sorting potatoes. Large ones in one pile and small ones in another. And he didn't work very long. He said, you know, it's just too hard work to make decisions. Every time I picked up one of those potatoes, I had to make a decision. Well, you know the stories that you used to tell about Governor McCrary down in this state. Governor McCrary, he had a way of avoiding decisions. And somebody said during his speech, how do you stand on prohibition? And he said, well, I'm glad you asked that question, and I'll be glad to give you an answer. If the people are for it, I'm for it. And the people are against it, I'm against it. And then they said one time, they were going along and they said, well, those sheep over there have just been sheared. And he said, well, on this side they have. He never would take responsibility of making a decision on anything. And so the stories go. Mary Presley Smith, I remember on a lesson somewhat like this one time, used to say, man who prayed, oh God, if there is any, save my soul if I have any. And when I die, if I ever do, take me to heaven if you want to. And I was a very young man when my father died. The hard problem I had was to make decisions. I'd always gone to him when any question came in. Ask him what to do. And then when he died, I had to make up my own mind. And that was the hardest transition that I ever had to make. You know how it is. You rely on somebody. You go to somebody to answer all your questions. And finally, when you grow up, you have to answer questions of your own. And the covenant they made, it was a very interesting thing. They made a covenant with God. You know, when our nation was formed, we made a covenant. We said all people are created by God with certain rights. And we drew up a constitution. It's a covenant. But the strange thing about it was not only a covenant made by those 3 million people or so that were then living in this country. It was a covenant binding future generations. That's the remarkable thing about it. How could they make a covenant that would bind their grandchildren? Well, of course they could change it. With certain curves, but they could change it. They could amend it. But as Moses points out here so carefully, they must constantly teach the young as they come along, because generations are changing. We don't live very long, you know. Since we die off one time, we just don't realize how rapidly generations are changing. We're constantly bringing up the young, and he emphasizes. And the Jews have pretty well lived up to that. And if they go into a country where they can't attend school, they have school for their own children. You know this famous picture of the devil and a young man sitting at a chessboard? Hung up there a long time, and somebody came along, and the devil had just moved. Somebody said, "Young man, it's your move next. You have to make a move." Mr. Rich loaned me this little volume of Hawthorne's on Bosses from an Old Manse. And in it, it has sort of a paraphrase, you know, of Pilgrim's Progress in one of the chapters there about the railway that goes to heaven. Mr. Smooth It Over sat down with this passenger, and he said everything was all right. No trouble. Mr. Smooth It Over. The most remarkable paraphrase of Hawthorne of Pilgrim's Progress. Well, there come times that we must make decisions decide every day of the year. Mark Hopkins said one time, "There are moments, oh how solemn, when destiny trembles in the balance and the preponderance of either scale is by our own choice." You remember during the worst times in the Second World War, George V of England broadcast to his people, and they were thrilled when he quoted this. "And I said to the man who stood at the gate of the air, 'Give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown.' And he replied, 'Go out into the darkness, put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light and safer than a known way.'" Churchill wrote this, "Consider well, weigh strictly and right, weigh right and wrong. Resolve, not quick, but once resolved, be strong. Rather stand up, assured with conscious pride, alone, than err with millions at your side. Choose ye this day, decide now for the right. To do this, my boy, it may mean a hard fight, but when the battle is ended, and the returns all in, you will find it paid big to decide against sin." And then our own text, "The Lord, he it is that doth go before thee. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed."